Hi, Jim.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. Good to be with you.
Good for you to join us. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Hits TV, and this is The Wright Show. You are Jim Walsh. We're lucky to have you because you are an expert on nuclear arms and nuclear arms negotiations, and today's a big day in that realm.
A big day.
A big day. There was this announcement that there was a kind of a framework agreement, I guess it's fair to call it.
Yeah.
Between Iran and so-called P5 plus one, permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, and that certainly includes the United States. It's being hailed as a big deal by both proponents and critics. Proponents say it's big, strong deal, very auspicious. Opponents say it ranks up there with Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler at Munich. Do you agree at least that with this consensus that it is momentous?
I do, and I would go on and point out a couple of things. There are some critics, or I should say some skeptics, who have had some positive response to the deal. Richard Haass, who head of Council on Foreign Relations, has come out and said some positive things about it. Gary Seymour, who's president of United Against Nuclear Iran.
Which is quite far to the right, I would say.
Yes, and it's certainly been very tough on the negotiations, very tough on the prospect of any deal.
Yeah.
Has said some positive things about it.
Right.
Olli Haininen, also a colleague downriver at Harvard, has been deeply skeptical and has said some positive things. So in the expert community, the skeptics have, I think, been surprised, as I was surprised, at the level of detail offered today and at the robustness of some of these details. Now, of course, you're going to get the Munich thing, right? We heard that this was a Hitler appeasement when we had the joint plan of action, and that this was the end of the world. That was a year ago last November, and that agreement turned out to be spectacular. You know, no 20% enrichment for very little sanctions relief. So this is just a thing that you're going to hear. I think for a lot of those folks who say, you know, this is a disaster, it wouldn't matter what was in the deal. There was no deal that we could have achieved where that press release would have changed one word.
Yeah. Now, in terms of what we know about it, what both sides kind of gave these, I gather, vague statements. And as an official matter, not a lot of text was disclosed, but the U.S. issued a very kind of carefully written what it called parameters of the deal. And I think maybe Iran's not all that enthusiastic about that because there's a difference of opinion about how much to make public and how much
yes.
to keep private for now, because the final
yes.
deadline isn't until June. But mainly what we have to go on is this U.S. list of parameters, and I gather you think it's reliable.
Yeah, I think so. I did see that Foreign Minister Zarif tweeted, a certain level of unhappiness about the release of those White House fact sheets. Remember, I think what is pushing the White House to do this is domestic politics in Washington. They want to be able to come out of the gate and sort of take charge politically on this. But, you know, Iran has its own domestic politics. And one of the difficult things about negotiations between countries that don't like each other, and that's what most negotiations are, countries who don't like each other, is managing the domestic politics in each capital. So when one side says, we won, then the hardliners in the other capital say, oh, look, President whoever, you sold us out,
right.
and vice versa. So as the Iranians say things over these next coming weeks and months about how great the deal is for them, how they didn't give up anything, how it's a victory for the Islamic Republic, you can bet that there'll be hardliners here in the U.S. who will seize upon those statements for their own political reasons. So it's a political dynamic that's unfortunate but unavoidable.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the deal from an American point of view stronger than you had expected, or weaker, or about what you had expected, or what?
I'd say it's somewhat stronger than I expected. So, for example, the Iraq reactor, they are going to just rebuild that thing. I didn't know if that was going to happen.
That's the so-called heavy water reactor, which
Correct.
Is separate
right.
from the centrifuges that have been spinning, which we'll get to.
Yeah, so there are two paths to the bomb. You can either use you have to use one of two materials, neither of which is found in nature. You can either take uranium and enrich it and produce highly enriched uranium. That's what the centrifuges are about. Or you can take plutonium. And the way you get plutonium is you run a particular type of reactor. It produces, as all reactors do, nuclear waste. But the nuclear waste from a heavy water reactor has a higher content of plutonium. And then you take that nuclear waste and you reprocess or extract the plutonium from the other elements, and then you use that to make a bomb. So people have concerns about the Arak heavy water reactor because it was a plutonium producer. And what they've done is agreed to basically rebuild the reactor from the ground up to start over. They also agreed to ship out any waste that that reactor produces, and they made a lifelong commitment not to reprocess. So those were all things that I thought were pretty strong. On the issue of what's called PMDs or possible military dimensions, this is an issue of what did Iran do in the past? It's alleged to have had a nuclear weapons program in the late 1990s, which it halted in 2003. What exactly was going on there? International Atomic Energy Agency wants to know, and they've had sort of this parallel process of trying to investigate that. But that wasn't going to go anywhere until we had a comprehensive agreement. But in the announcement today, I was surprised to see that, yes, there'll be a new UN Security Council resolution to replace the old UN Security Council resolutions, but that's not going to happen until the PMD issue, this issue of the history, is resolved.
To the satisfaction of the IAEA, the International Inspectorate.
Exactly. So I thought that was a surprise as well.
Yeah. Now, could that be a problem? Because, I mean, you know, Iran probably was looking into the militarization of nuclear weapons at that point. And I think it's worth remembering that at that point, you know, in the not too distant past from their point of view, they had had a horrendous war with Iraq, which at that point, they, like us, probably thought was developing nuclear weapons.
Yes.
So you can think of all sorts of reasons they would have wanted a nuclear weapon other than to destroy America or Israel. But the fact is they probably did have a program. And so is this going to be a sticking point? I mean, is it enough if they kind of come clean and say, yeah, we did, and the IAEA says, okay, you've been honest, now let's proceed? I mean, what's your view of this?
Well, luckily, again, this is not the first time we've had to deal with this. And the agency, the IAEA, has had to, under different circumstances, deal with countries that had nuclear weapons programs and then come in after the fact and certify them. In the case of South Africa, they had a nuclear weapons program and were outside of the NPT. But both with Iraq had violations of its NPT obligations.
That's the nuclear non-proliferation
treaty that were discovered in 1991. But also, people forget this, South Korea and Egypt engaged in problematic activities. And the International Atomic Energy Agency had to go in and address those files. And so what I think you're going to find is something that's in between 0 and 100. It's not going to be Iran's going to get down on its knees and say, mea culpa, we did all these bad things, we had a bomb program. That ain't going to happen. But they're not going to stonewall and say nothing either. And the way this is resolved is the IAEA goes in and has some quiet conversations with the people involved in the program. They get the information they need. We've seen some of this already. So there are these electronic bridge experiments that might have been done. Iran says, yes, we did them, but we did them because we were working on explosives for construction. So everyone gets to have this resolved. No one has to be embarrassed, but you get the information that you need. So my guess is they will be able to do that. They've been able to do it before in other cases, and I would hope with so much at stake, they'll be able to do it here as well.
So then this has to happen kind of over what time frame? If you imagine the deal being sealed in June, the expectation is that the new UN Security Council resolution, which is contingent on the resolution of the possible military dimensions, the PMD thing, the expectation is that would be happening by when?
You know, they didn't say, and I don't know, but my own guess is it would be sooner rather than later, partly because Iran has a strong desire to move on from the current UN Security Council resolutions. Mm-hmm. The agency and Iran have already, as I said, in a parallel process, been in dialogue over this. There's a list of 12 or 14 or whatever points that need to be addressed, and a framework for addressing them. They've addressed, I don't know, two, three, some subset of that. My guess is once there's a comprehensive agreement, then the progress on that will move much more quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a date specific, but I would say it's going to happen sooner rather than later.
Okay. Now let's get to the centrifuges issue. I mean, there's a couple of things we knew for sure. One is that Iran was going to be allowed to enrich at levels appropriate for a civilian energy program, but not for levels appropriate for weaponization. And the other was that at some point, the you know, really inordinate inspections regime and restrictions on the program at some point in the future were going to be lifted, although thereafter, the idea is they will remain members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, be subject to some inspections, and be committed to keeping the program peaceful. Now, the two things I noticed are, okay, in terms of what time frame this happens over, for 10 years, a small number of relatively crude centrifuges are allowed to spin. And then for 15 years, they can't enrich above like 3.5% or something, which is very, very low level, well below, you know, weaponizable.
Yes.
So those are kind of the two key numbers there.
Yes.
And then after that, it's kind of more normal. Some of, you know, there's still inspection, but everyone's a little
less. They'll still have their safeguards agreements, and also will have resolve this outstanding question about one part of the safeguards they weren't abiding by, the so-called subsidiary code 3.1, which we don't have to go into. But the main point being, they have their safeguards obligations, that those go into perpetuity forever, and then they'll also have the additional protocol that will be forever.
So what are the safeguard obligations that are in perpetuity? Just in
When you sign up for safeguards, they are in perpetuity. And then that also applies to the additional protocol, which is a set of enhancements to the international safeguards regime that gives the agency the ability to try to detect undeclared facilities and improves their ability to find, which was devised after the revelation about Saddam Hussein's nuclear program in the early 1990s, when the agency was simply restricted to sites that were declared by the country.
So the additional protocol to the NPT, which they're signing on to as a result of this, that allows offsite inspections. Like,
if we get
suspicious, the IAEA gets suspicious, they say we need to look at this place we're not ordinarily inspecting. And then the safeguards you referred to, that refers to the more ordinary monitoring of the known facilities.
Correct.
So both of those things remain in perpetuity unless Iran chooses, as any member of the NPT has the right to do, actually, to get out of the NPT.
Yes, which would be highly unlikely. But yes, that's exactly right. I would also say that it sounds like, now, I don't think we'll really know the answer to this till the deal is signed and inked in late June. But it also sounds like some of the voluntary unilateral commitments by Iran are also extend beyond the 25-year commitment. We're going to have to check this, but it sounds like the no reprocessing commitment is also one that goes on.
That applies to the heavy water reactor, or
yes, right. So you know, even if you have a reactor, if you don't reprocess, you can't get the plutonium. Or the only way to get the plutonium is if you have a reprocessing plant.
Okay. And the 25, where I saw the 25-year number, and I was kind of surprised that for 25 years, we can monitor their uranium mines. So,
yes.
So we would know, I mean, people worry about, sneak out.
Yes.
Which, you know, doing something covertly. And the additional protocol is designed to do something toward that. But separate from that, I gather, we'll be monitoring, we'll know what they're doing at the legitimate sites. We'll know how much uranium is coming out of their mines. So unless they're on the black market, I guess, getting uranium from somewhere we don't know, then that provides some kind of additional confidence. And that lasts for 25 years, which is a long time.
Yeah, and I would say on this issue of sneak out, I mean, all these things are legitimate concerns. It doesn't mean they're likely. And on sneak out, I think it's worth keeping in mind, one, if there's no agreement, you don't have to worry about sneak out because you can build all the secret facilities you want, and that doesn't violate any agreement, right? The other thing is it would be really odd for Iran to sign an agreement that will more than double the number of inspectors on the ground and give those inspectors a broader mandate and then decide to cheat. Right. That would be really dumb.
Right.
And then the third thing to say about it is, you know, Iran is the most watched country in the world in terms of national intelligence agencies. You know, Israel's watching, Saudi's watching, the French are watching, the Russians are watching, we're watching, everyone's watching. Mm-hmm. That ain't going to change, right? The Israelis still hate the Iranians, whether there's a nuke deal or not. The Saudis hate the Iranians, whether there's a nuclear deal or not. The U.S. and Russia are going to continue to keep an eye on Iran going forward. And if there's anything we should have learned from the revelations from Snowden, it's that at least the U.S., and maybe others too, but at least the U.S., has tremendous capacity for watching the behavior of states.
Right. It's a good point. I mean, that's why the opposition to the deal, I've kind of wondered about the actual motivation, because when you look at the actual alternative to a deal, it's not something that would be embraced by anyone who actually wants to keep them from getting a weapon. Because I think everyone agrees. I mean, first of all, you're right. If there's no deal and we don't have all these inspectors, that's obviously worse. Now, you might say, well, then we'll bomb them. But I think everyone agrees that if you bomb them, what that does is actually ensure that they will then seek and obtain a nuclear weapon. Because ultimately, they can do it if they want to, unless we literally invade and occupy the country.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's some good social science evidence to suggest, and it would apply in the Iranian case, that like Iraq, if you bomb them, they're going to come out the next day more committed than ever. You know, Iran is a prideful country, and I think bombing them actually produces the very thing you're trying to avoid. Remember, the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, has testified repeatedly in open session that Iran has not yet made a decision to pursue nuclear weapons. They have a basic capability because they know how to build a centrifuge. You can't bomb that knowledge out of their heads. You know, you can't bomb the fact that they know how to build one out of them. And so they have a basic capability. That horse has left the barn. So the core issue is the political will to do so. And if they haven't decided to do that yet, which is what the top U.S. intelligence official says, then this is the time. This is the critical opportunity to put them on a different track, you know, when they haven't decided. So they end up like all those other countries, 30 plus countries that started down the path towards nuclear weapons at some point during the nuclear age and then stopped and reversed course. This is the moment, the window that is really ripe for that. And that's what I think this agreement will do.
You know, the other thing that occurred to me is from a strategic point of view, there's in some sense having breakout capacity, which they have and will always have. In other words, they could over some period of time build a bomb if they wanted to.
Yes.
And in some sense, that's a stronger thing to have in your arsenal than an actual nuclear weapon. Because if you've got breakout capacity, you can plausibly threaten to build a nuclear weapon if people annoy you enough, right? Whereas if you've got a nuclear weapon, everyone knows you're not going to actually use it. It doesn't happen. I mean, nobody thinks Israel is going to. Has anybody ever been deterred from doing anything to Israel out of concern for their nuclear arsenal?
Well, the test for that would have been the 73 war.
Yeah.
And that did not stop Egypt and Syria and the others from launching the 73 war, because Israel had nuclear weapons by 1966.
Yeah.
So nuclear weapons, you know, I'm not a big fan of nuclear weapons. I think they do provide what I would call lumpy deterrence. They do make it hard for countries to credibly threaten existential threats to wipe you off the map.
To actually mount a substantial invasion, it would make them think twice. But I mean, people who worry about Iran are not worried about that. They're worried about Iran like throwing its weight around in all these ways because of nuclear weapons.
I think the evidence for that is very poor. I think nuclear weapons do not get you a lot of a coercive bargaining leverage. I think they're mostly good for existential deterrence. But then, of course, they come at this great cost, because it's costs and benefits, that you can end up using them through error, mistake, miscalculation, whatever. And then at that point, the cost-benefit calculation switches wildly if they ever get used. But I think they offer, you know, they've offered some countries some rough, lumpy deterrence. My own view, though, is the whole nuclear enterprise, you know, there is not perfection on Earth. We cannot guarantee that nuclear weapons built will never be used. So I prefer that we have fewer rather than more. I also prefer that we have fewer countries with nuclear weapon capabilities rather than more. But the main goal here has to be preventing the nuclear weapons themselves. And if we allow Iran, or, you know, if Iran has a small enrichment program under heavy surveillance and is part of the international community where the whole incentive structure for them is different, that's a better outcome than if they go rogue and there's no... They're isolated and feel threatened and have no restrictions on the program.
Now, it just occurred to me, I'm not sure I mentioned your affiliation. You're at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the, what is the Security Studies program there?
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
I'm not sure if I remembered that at the beginning. Now, one issue was the question of sanctions relief. You know, Iran's got all the sanctions on it. A concern had been, especially from critics of a deal, that we would, you know, end all the sanctions at once and thereafter have no leverage to make sure that Iran maintained compliance. Now, the parameters released by the U.S. refer to snapback provisions, certainly in the United Nations sanctions. Apparently, they figured out a way, I guess, have they, of, on the one hand, ending the sanctions from the United Nations, but having a provision where the sanctions will snap back, and then there's a in the event of Iranian noncompliance, and then there's a comparable reference to U.S. sanctions, which is a different and maybe in a way more complicated matter. But am I right that they think they have solved that problem?
Well, I think you're right to say that that is the claim by the U.S. And I think we're going to have to. My guess is that's one of the issues that hasn't probably been fully worked out that will be addressed over the next 3 months. The good thing about UN Security Council resolutions, which are international law, that there are different sources of international law. An International Court of Justice ruling is international law. Other things can be international law. Security Council resolutions are international law. And they have the power to write whatever documents saying whatever they want. Mm-hmm. So they can write a new resolution that says, provisions A, F, and G in the old resolutions are struck and don't count anymore, but we're going to keep paragraph Z and Q. And so that there's some flexibility there where they can say Iran is no longer to be internationally isolated, but where they still might be able to retain the ability to come back should there be problems down the road. But I think that's going to be a tough thing to work out. But that's what diplomats do for a living. And at least with Security Council resolutions, there's a lot of discretion and therefore room to try to figure out an answer.
Yeah, I mean the tricky thing is that if you have to exercise the discretion with a new resolution down the road,
yes,
then critics of a deal will say, well, what if Russia bails out on us? Which
of
is
course.
Not a totally crazy thing.
Absolutely, given the state of U.S.-Russian relations, absolutely.
And Congress is a different kettle of fish, been maybe just too complicated to get into because, for various
reasons. Well, I think, you know, on the U.S. side, I divide it up into executive sanctions, that is to say, sanctions whose origin is in the executive, and the president has the power to completely nullify those or offer waivers or do whatever the president wants to do. Mm-hmm. That's an executive function. Then there are a set of sanctions that are passed by Congress that have in that sanctions legislation provisions for presidential waiver. Mm-hmm. So the president can waive those congressional sanctions on nuclear. You'll notice that in the announcements today, the reference was to nuclear-related sanctions. So sanctions that are because of terrorism or discrimination against religious minorities or whatever, those are going to continue on the books. Mm-hmm. Then there's final sort of set of sanctions that it's not clear that Congress has passed where they've tried to limit the president's authority. that are under contention, and whether, you know, this is a point where there's sort of a constitutional question between the role of the executive and the role of the legislative. That hasn't been fully resolved on those because they haven't really been challenged. And eventually Iran would like to see the whole sanctions architecture to go away, to not just sort of live 6 months at a time to 6 months at a time getting waivers. They're going to want to see, they're going to say, hey, we've been abiding by this for 10, 20 years, time to get rid of this thing. And at that point, Congress will have to repeal them. Mm-hmm. But God knows what sort of politics we'll have 10 or 15 years from now.
Well, and what sort of international relations, I think, unless the character of American politics changes, I would say we're going to have to see something like rapprochement between Iran and the rest of the world before the kind of Congress we have now would be satisfied, right? You'd have to have something fundamental change about international relations.
Well, I could imagine, you know, it's not, if you look back, so let's talk for a moment about the region, and because I think that's what's driving this rather than globally. It's the regional politics and their influence on U.S. domestic politics. Mm-hmm. And so what we're really talking about is Israel and Saudi Arabia. There was a time when even with the Shah of Iran, who was in public highly critical of Israel, that Israel and Iran, both non-Arab states, right? Turkey, Iran, and Israel are non-Arab states.
Right.
Actually, behind closed doors, collaborated. During the Iran-Iraq War, Israel helped Iran, helped mm-hmm. the Islamic Republic in its war against mm-hmm. Iraq. Mm-hmm. So it's not inconceivable. I mean, it's not necessarily the case that Israel will forever be ruled by right-wing Likud governments,
right?
They're you know, and that could get better or that could get worse. You know, as you look at the future of Israel, and I have no idea which way it's going to go, but at least in principle, it's not impossible for Israel and Iran to have better relations. The Saudi-Iran relationship is more difficult, but in 20 years that could change too. And if I might just digress momentarily on this, one of the less understood consequences of the Gulf War was changing the balance of power in the region. Mm-hmm. In the old days, I just finished writing a book chapter on this for an edited volume. In the old days, you had Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia, and that triangle led to balancing. So, you know, Iran, and particularly Iran and Iraq, had strong regional aspirations, wanted to dominate the region under the Shah in particular, under Saddam, but at other times too. And then Saudi Arabia would sort of play it as it went, balancing with Iran against Iraq if Iraq looked more threatening, mm-hmm. with Iraq against Iran if Iran looked more threatening. Well, after we deposed Saddam and Iraq collapsed, that balancing mechanism went away. And mm-hmm. so that just left Saudi Arabia and Iran, who have gone after each other without constraint. Now, if Iraq develops into a real country and in 20 years down the line sort of becomes a normal country that's more Arab, right? It's an Arab country, not a Persian country. Mm-hmm. We might see a return to that more traditional pre-2003 international relations or regional relations, and that might create a little more space.
Right. So there's kind of a couple of take-homes there. For all the emphasis that's been put lately on the role of sectarian and ethnic affiliation in Middle East conflicts, the fact is that historically there has been realpolitik played at the national level that has transcended those considerations, A. And B, in the case of Iran and Iraq, yes, there's a substantial Shia population in Iraq, as in Iran, but it's still an Arab country that speaks a different language from Iran. So it's not as if even if all you're paying attention to is ethnicity and sect, there's some kind of, you know, inherent affinity between...
Right, absolutely, because there are Arab speakers in Iran and Khuzestan province, losing my voice here, and they're largely pro-Iran, even though they speak Arabic. And all, during the Iran-Iraq War, there were a lot of Shia Iraqis who were fighting Iran during the Iran-Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Different analysts have different views. I'm of more of the view that in time, if Iraq is able to get its act together and become a normal country, then you're going to see it pull back from Iran. And in part because the stronger, the more Iran tries to influence, there's sort of almost a security dilemma to soft power here, which is to say, the harder Iran tries to influence Iraq, the more over time they're going to tick off the Iraqis, and you're going to get a backlash against that. They don't want to be Iran's little brother. They don't want to be told what to do.
Right.
And in time, they'll probably develop their own national politics. I mean, even now, the government of Iraq has a different policy towards Syria than Iran does, even though Syria is very important to Iran.
Okay, well, you're losing your voice, understandably, since you've done a lot of media on this very issue, including places like Fox News. Congratulations for venturing into that territory.
So I do a lot of Fox News, and I have a good time when I go on.
Yeah, and it's a debate. And debates are great. So two quick closing questions, I guess. I kind of suspect that opponents of a deal are a little disappointed by what came out today. I think it's going to be a tougher target than they had hoped based on the reporting of the last few days. Can you, and you're nodding ahead for those people listening on audio podcast, you seem to agree. So can you tell me, what do you think most troubles them about the deal that they are now that they will now try to attack? A, and then B, what is from supporters of a deal from their point of view? What is the biggest vulnerability? What's the argument they're going to have the hardest time fending off from opponents?
Yeah, I think for the skeptics, I think they are disappointed. They're disappointed that some of the skeptics have come out and said good things about the deal. They're disappointed that it beat expectations. As you know, we're going into a presidential election year, and anyone who watches presidential politics knows you can win a primary not by winning, but by beating expectations. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened today. Mm-hmm. This is a stronger deal and a more detailed deal than anyone would have guessed. And I think right now, with a deal in hand, the political advantage will go to the president. And it'll be easier for him to hold on to Democrats. And this is a legacy issue for him. And I think the proponents have lost some important blocks on Capitol Hill. That is to say, the skeptics have lost some important blocks, like the Black Caucus, for example. I think the whole Netanyahu thing has really turned them off. Mm-hmm. So I think that's not going to stop them from opposing the deal. They have majorities. That's not going to stop them from passing bills that are unhelpful, but they're not going to be able to override a veto. So I think they're probably concerned right now. I would say for proponents of the agreement, it's not so much a set of arguments that are going to be offered as it is what's going to happen over these next 3 months. You know, we're feeling good today. Those who like this agreement and think it's going to help us with a non-proliferation, but over the next 3 months, things could fall apart. They might not be able to resolve the issues they've sort of pushed off, like the actual content of a UN Security Council resolution. There could be pushback in Iran, you know, to the White House fact sheet or to other claims.
I wondered about that. I mean, as you said, their foreign minister tweeted his dissatisfaction with the U.S. releasing that. And I think that complicates his life, his domestic politics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think there are some unknowns here. There's work left to be done. There are political spoilers in both Tehran and Washington that are going to be beavering away to try to undermine this negotiation. And there are still some tough issues to resolve. So I think those who would like to see diplomacy succeed, those are going to be the challenges ahead, rather than so much debates about whether this is a good agreement or not.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Jim Walsh at MIT, thanks so much for taking the time. Maybe you can come back down the road as things evolve and clue us in again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.